Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Here's an impeachment news soundbite that popped into public view over the weekend. It's from Senator Lindsey Graham, generally a staunch Trump loyalist on things like this, right? And the conventional wisdom is the Republican Senate will never remove Trump from office, even if the House impeaches him. But listen to what Lindsey Graham told Axios for their show on HBO.
Show me something that is a crime. If you could show me that, you know, Trump actually was engaging in a quid pro quo outside the phone call, that would be very disturbing.
That would be very disturbing. That was recorded a few days before White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney answered a reporter's question about quid pro quos by saying, yes, investigating the 2016 election was a condition for Ukraine. And
I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy.
But people aren't over it, obviously. And let's see what Lindsey Graham, as a bellwether, an indicator for the Republican Senate, says next when he's confronted with that. Our guests today are Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the Supreme Court and other legal things for Slate and hosts the legal affairs podcast Amicus, and Kyle Chaney, who covers Congress for Politico. Hi, Kyle. Hi, Dahlia. Thanks for coming on today.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Kyle, what do you make of Lindsey Graham opening the door a crack like that?
Well, I don't know if he anticipated what the acting chief of staff was going to say. And so now the question will be, you know, and I think the fact is Mick Mulvaney, who made that comment, has since walked it back. And I think that's what a lot of Republicans are going to hang their hopes on here, is that walk back was more accurate than the chief of staff's original comments, which sort of seemed to confirm the quid pro quo.
But we went over this on Friday's show, and of course so many other media have as well, when Jonathan Carl from ABC and Ayesha Rascoe from NPR were saying, wait, but you said, do you really mean? And he kept confirming it. So his attempts to walk it back over the weekend, I think, were feeble. But has any reporter, as far as you know, gotten to Lindsey Graham after the Mulvaney remarks?
I have not seen anyone talk to him, so that's going to be high on everyone's priority list today, sort of get his response, given what he said to Axios in the pre-recorded interview, you know, now to sort of square that with what we now know from Mulvaney. So could put him in a bit of a corner on that.
And before I bring in Dahlia, do you think that Lindsey Graham is something of a bellwether, an indicator for the potential for Republicans in the Senate to actually convict, therefore remove Trump from office once he's impeached by the House, based on him opening the door a crack the way he did?
You know, he'd be more than a bellwether. I mean, he's been someone who has hugged the president as close as you could imagine, especially for someone who used to be such a harsh critic of the president in 2016 and even beyond. So if he were to somehow be open in a real way to impeachment, that would signal a real sea change of the politics of this.
Dahlia, this was a week of Trump world trying to undo things that they did. Three huge things. They announced the withdrawal of troops from Syria, allowing Turkey to invade, then placed sanctions on Turkey and got a five-day pause after there was so much blowback. Mulvaney confessing to a political quid pro quo for foreign policy, then trying to say he was misunderstood. That's number two. And Trump announcing the G7 next year for his own Doral resort in Florida, then Saturday night canceling that in a tweet. You wrote a piece the other day saying the Doral G7 deal by itself is worthy of impeachment. Want to make that case?
Yeah, actually, I think that was Mark Stern's piece.
Oh, that was another Slate piece. Sorry.
I'll happily credit him with it. But I think that the point was that this really crystallized this emoluments problem. And I think part of what's been strange is that the word emoluments was obscure. This was a, you know, these are a series of cases that were filed against Donald Trump in the first weeks of the presidency, saying, in effect, he was violating, there's two different clauses in the Constitution, a foreign and a domestic emoluments clause. Both of them preclude the president from profiting off the presidency, either because foreigners are putting money in his pockets or domestic entities are putting money in his pockets. These lawsuits have just stutter-stepped for 2 years now, trying to get some judicial resolution on whether it is constitutionally inappropriate for, say, Bill Barr to host a huge party at the Trump Hotel where all the money goes to Trump, or it's appropriate for taxpayers to pay massive sums of money so that the Trump family can travel to their own hotel and drink from their own bars. And it's never been resolved in the courts. It's still working its way up through various courts. And so I think this was a really crisp articulation of this very obscure, never used constitutional provision about the president in effect self-enriching and promoting his hotel and the actual value and brand recognition of his hotel with foreign donations from foreign countries attending the G7. And I think if you bracket everything else, you can say we always knew that was unconstitutional. This was just a perfectly crisp slice of emolument pie that everybody could understand.
A crisp slice of emolument pie. Yum. But Mulvaney, the chief of staff, said Trump was surprised by the pushback. I don't think I believe that because it was so clear. I have a theory, but what do you think they were up to, Dahlia?
Well, I think it's of a piece with this larger rope-a-dope that's been going on for a long time, which is when Donald Trump is caught either doing something unconstitutional or patently illegal, the first answer is we're not doing it. The second answer is we're doing it, but everyone does it. That's what Kyle just described in terms of the quid pro quo in the Ukraine call. And then I think the third take of that little waltz is not only do we do it and everyone does it and it's not illegal, but you'd be stupid not to do it. And that's kind of been the way they've power washed every bad move. And so I think that this was a good example of, oh, well, you know, Trump is first and foremost in the hospitality industry, is what Mulvaney said on Fox News. He's only kind of secondarily the president. And so he was really kind of shocked to know that it might be inappropriate to use his own hotel and raise, you know, millions and millions of dollars from foreign entities staying there. So I think it's a pretty good example of that same little maneuver that's worked so well. You know, first deny it when you're caught with your hand in a cookie jar, and say, okay, well, yeah, we did it, but it's not a crime. And then say, it would be nuts for him not to profit off his fantastic hotel brand, which everyone loves. And by the way, you should totally go stay there. Book your rooms now.
Yeah. And my theory, a little harsh maybe, is, Kyle, that Trump was actually trying to consolidate another piece of authoritarian rule. The blurring of, you know, what somebody can do as a political leader and what somebody can do to enrich themselves and enhance their own power and not go by the rules, either in convention or in law or even in the U.S. Constitution, establishing a kind of one-man rule. To what degree, for you as a congressional reporter, did Republicans in Congress actually push back on this in a way that surprised the White House?
This was actually a notable incident here because, you know, as you sort of described, the president, his MO has been to sort of push the boundaries a little bit further all the time, inch by inch, to sort of blow past these guardrails that have been up historically for elected officials and presidents in particular. So, and he's done that largely without any serious Republican pushback. You get a lot of tut-tutting, little, you know, critiques here and there, but no one serious about pushing back on him. And so I think what they've found here is actually there may be a limit somewhere way out there where real Republican pushback can actually shape the White House's behavior. This comes during an active impeachment investigation that has been uncovering significant evidence of wrongdoing that could feed impeachment. It's coming at a time that the president already infuriated his allies based on his moves in Syria and Turkey and sort of green lighting the Turkish incursion there. And so then to layer this G7 issue on top of that, which is very hard for Republicans to defend, you saw them speak out in a real way, and I think that's why the White House actually pulled back so quickly.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls on the impeachment news for Dahlia Lithwick from Slate and Kyle Cheney from Politico. Dahlia on the legal beat and Kyle, the congressional reporter, at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Kyle, you report that one of the ways Democrats hope to prove impeachable offenses is to show that the president directed Rudy Giuliani's plans, goals, and tactics. Can you get more specific about what they would try to establish?
Sure. And so I think it's pretty understood that Giuliani was acting at the president's sort of behest when he was going around trying to pressure Ukrainian officials and talk to them about investigating Joe Biden and elements of the 2016 election. What I think Democrats want to show is not just that Rudy Giuliani had the president's, you know, general approval, but that they were engaged on the specific tactics he was using, on who he was talking to, and when. And so there can't be this sort of effort to show any daylight, like, oh, maybe the president didn't know what Rudy Giuliani was up to specifically. And I think Democrats are trying to say, look, whatever Rudy Giuliani did was basically with Trump's understanding and knowledge and approval.
And you report that Republicans seem to be developing a strategy of criticizing Giuliani, but portraying him as a one-man rogue operation. Did that get any harder after the last week of testimony in the House?
It did, and I think what has trickled out, and that's only a fraction of what the testimony actually will end up showing, I imagine, is that everyone in the State Department, foreign policy establishment understood that if you wanted to influence Trump, you had to influence Rudy Giuliani first, and that was a predominant theme from multiple ambassadors, and that makes it hard to put any daylight between Giuliani and the president.
Dahlia, how do you see Rudy's position today in legal terms? Is he under criminal investigation by the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office?
You know, I've seen a lot of people asserting that it's formally at the place where he's now being criminally investigated. I haven't seen that corroborated, and maybe Kyle knows more than I do. I would say that a really significant thing that may have gotten lost in the shuffle last night with respect to Judy is that the Justice Department put out this really weird statement, effectively saying, we didn't know when we were talking to him about his clients. That they were, about to be indicted. This is Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, who were charged last week. But I think that the fact that the Justice Department itself has had to say, we didn't know what the Southern District of New York was doing, and we certainly wouldn't have been sitting around chatting with Giuliani if we'd known how close he was to this particular debacle. I've actually never seen a Justice Department statement then like that, and I think there were several other folks who made that point when it came out. So whether or not he's formally where that investigation is, it's certainly clear that the Justice Department is now in this weird position where simultaneously it's been meeting at the highest level with Giuliani about his clients, treating him not only as Trump's lawyer, but, you know, as some vaunted member of this administration's legal process. And at the same time, now having to wash their hands of him and say, sort of as Kyle just implied, I don't even know the guy. He was just, you know, changing the president's ashtrays. So I think the Justice Department, that pivot from the DOJ, I think is really significant.
So all of that on Rudy Giuliani, does it rub off on Trump legally?
Well, I think it's, you know, we're going to have to wait and see. But I think that, you know, part of what's been so profoundly confusing is even in the last week and a half, Giuliani's been making claims to represent the president privately. He said when he was caught out initially in some of this Ukraine stuff, oh, no, I was actually tasked by the State Department at the highest levels. I was actually a lawyer for the State Department. And then in different iterations makes the claim that he's representing representing, you know, the White House. So I think part of what we have to do, and obviously, I mean, this is law school 101. You can't have all those different clients. Who is he in a lawyer-client relationship with? And I think part of that murk, as it gets unpacked, is going to highlight exactly the extent to which he was an agent of Donald Trump in so many of these interactions. And so it's confusing right now, but I would say the best way to think about this is a lawyer cannot have, say, attorney-client privilege with 56 different entities, and he's walking around at different times when it suits him claiming to be the attorney for X, Y, and Z here. That can't all be correct.
Here's a question that we retrieved from our voicemail over the weekend from a listener. Listen.
This is Milo from California. So what I'm curious about comes from the fact that impeachment in the Constitution isn't very clearly defined. So what my question is what has been defined already by precedent in past impeachment inquiries, but more pressingly, what stands to be defined in our current inquiry?
That sounds like a legal eagle question for you, Dahlia.
Yeah, and I'm actually so glad she asked it, because it's a little bit an answer to the question you asked Kyle about Lindsey Graham and high crimes and misdemeanors. If you listened carefully, what Senator Graham said in that interview was, this doesn't amount to a crime, right? What I heard about the Ukraine doesn't amount to a crime. And then he used the quid pro quo language. And I just want to be super clear that that is the White House doing essentially what they did when they said no collusion around the Mueller report. Saying no quid pro quo or no crime, those are White House talking points about what high crimes and misdemeanors means for constitutional purposes. And so the question is so apt to the moment, because high crimes and misdemeanors, as laid out in the Constitution, treason and bribery are the specific examples the framers then lay out, has nothing to do with whether you committed a quote-unquote crime. And so you don't need to have met the felony statute, or you don't have to meet criminal bribery threshold. You don't have to have a quid pro quo criminal interaction. The framers were really, really clear that high crimes and misdemeanors could be non-criminal acts. They had to be terrible, heinous abuses of power. And so for the specific question, the kinds of things that we know were the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon, for instance, was abuse of power, right? Abuse of his presidential power. It was failure to respond to subpoenas, and it was obstruction. Those were the three articles that the House eventually voted on against Nixon. And as we know, he stepped down before Nixon could be convicted. And if you look at those three separate, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors, none of them need to be crimes. They just need to be things that you can prove in a Senate trial. And all three of those things map on to the kinds of things that the House is looking at now, right? Abuse of power, obstruction of justice, ignoring subpoenas. And so I think it's fair to say that if you use the Nixon Watergate articles of impeachment, they map pretty cleanly onto the kinds of things we're seeing Trump accused of doing. And if those things can be proven in the Senate, there never needs to be a kind of quid pro quo criminal bribery allegation at all. That is a way of reframing what high crimes and misdemeanors means. It's completely separate from what the framers anticipated.
Let's go back to Congress. Kyle, the next key witness after a week of incredible testimony last week, the next key witness goes to Congress tomorrow, William Taylor, Trump's current envoy to Ukraine, who wrote some of those incredulous text messages about quid pro quos over the summer, especially to Trump's EU ambassador, Gordon Sondland. Let me get into the weeds a little on these with you, because they're potentially so big when taken all together, and the language is so stark and really so interesting. On September 1st, Taylor texted Sondland, quote, "Are we now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations?" Sondland replies, "Call me." And on September 9th, Taylor texted, quote, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign," unquote. And then several hours on that day, after talking to Trump, it's been reported that he checked with Trump, Sondland replies, quote, Bill, I believe you are incorrect about President Trump's intentions. The president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quos of any kind. And Sondland adds, I suggest we stop the back and forth by text, unquote, meaning he didn't like this paper trail. So, Kyle, how central are Bill Taylor's texts, 8 days apart, those two, and just last month, under the clear impression these are conditions for the meeting and the military aid that Ukraine wants? How central is Bill Taylor and his documentary evidence to the impeachment inquiry today?
He may be the most significant witness left to go until you reach the level of people like Mick Mulvaney or John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor. The texts are, until Mick Mulvaney spoke, were the most crucial piece of evidence about what was happening contemporaneously while military aid was being withheld. And so, you know, we also have Sondland. We know he testified last week that the only reason he said there was no quid pro quo was because the president told him that in a phone call right before he sent that text. So Bill Taylor's impression that military aid was being held up specifically to help Trump's campaign was something that had stood for at least a week, and you look at the timeline of his text messages, and was never contradicted. And now you have Sondland sort of walking back a little bit his claim there was no quid pro quo. So Bill Taylor can talk about how why he had that impression, why he was so certain that military aid was being held up to benefit the president politically. And seems like he's ready to do that, like his colleagues on those texts, Sondland and former Ambassador Kurt Volker, did, and really sort of undercut the president's defense on this.
And the Taylor and Sondland text exchanges in September connect with text message exchanges in August, among others of these players. On August 17th, Sondland asked the previous Ukraine envoy, Kurt Volker, quote, do we still want Z, President Zelensky, to give us an unequivocal draft with 2016 and Burisma? Volker, that's the clear message so far, unquote. And of course, Burisma means the Bidens, and 2016 is that debunked conspiracy theory, everyone calls it debunked, about Ukraine, not Russia, hacking the DNC. And let's go back another month. July 19th, Volker texted Sondland, most important is for Zelensky to say that he will help investigation. That is, you know, it's just a flat out statement of what the president seemed to be requiring here. And Taylor in July, going back to Bill Taylor in July, texted Sondland that Zelensky, quote, is sensitive about Ukraine being taken seriously, not merely as an instrument in Washington domestic reelection politics. And Sondland replies, POTUS really wants the deliverable. Now, Dahlia, all those texts, plus Mick Mulvaney's statement last week, seem to make it super clear what the deliverable is. POTUS really wants the deliverable, or deliverables. For you as a legal analyst, and I know you just said in your previous answer, these impeachment questions don't have to stand up in a court of law. They only have to stand up in the court of the Senate. But would they not already have enough evidence to convict someone in a court of law if this was a conventional legal case?
Oh, yeah. I want to be clear. When I said there doesn't have to be a quid pro quo in order to have an impeachable offense, I did not mean to say that having a quid pro quo, an actual, you know, you will start this investigation, you will find dirt on the Bidens, you will somehow implicate Ukraine in stealing the 2016 election so that Russia's off the hook, in exchange for which we will give you already appropriated military aid that Congress has insisted that we give you. That's really bad. So I don't want to suggest that without the quid pro quo, this is goes away. I think the point is it was enough simply to ask. The asking alone for Trump and his various underlings to simply say to Zelensky, we're not going to give you this aid unless you search, you must search would have been enough for impeachment purposes. But you're absolutely right. Once you start actually conditioning military desperately needed and awaited for aid to an ally who is relying on it, on thus getting the dirt on the Bidens, on clearing Russia in the election, then you're in a whole other realm. Now you're quite right that we can start to talk about bribery or blackmail or whatever box you want to put it in. So I think it's maybe the best way to say or to reframe what I've been saying is that it's certainly sufficient to have had simply the ask for the aid to start an impeachment inquiry. But you're absolutely right to say there are a whole bunch of people who actually did the quid pro quo stuff that I said is more than sufficient. Mm-hmm. And that is now on the table as well. Yeah.
Let's take another call. Peter. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hey, Brian. Good morning. And good morning to you guys. This is related to a theory that I have about the Doral Resort and the G7 summit. A theory that I didn't hear this morning that I want to also offer is that the walk back was intentional, meaning to say that it was known from the very beginning that there would be a walk back, but that the walk back itself gives the Trump administration some redeeming quality, as if it's really got its finger on the pulse of the public and it took the high road.
Interesting theory. Kyle, do you think there's anything to that? That would be some, you know, multi-layered chess or whatever
is. There's always people who want to say there is a degree of 3D chess here, and maybe another version of that theory is that in the walk back, the president still gets to tout the wonders and amazing features of Doral while saying we're not going to have it there, but here's all these great things about it, and gets to talk. People are talking about his resort, even if they don't use it for the G7. So it somehow still accrues a bit of a benefit. There's that school of thought, and there's a school of thought that the president only thinks, you know, about how to get through the next 10 minutes and doesn't foresee the consequences of certain decisions and actions, and only responds when he can't withstand it anymore.
Since impeachment and removal are political acts, not court of law acts, as Dolly was so clearly explaining, are these things adding up in Republicans' minds? All of this quid pro quo evidence is one big thing, obviously, but also the fact that Trump was trying to do the Doral deal to benefit his own company, and the debacle with Syria, with, you know, implications of green lighting a genocide, literally, that might add to Republicans' inclination to potentially at some point vote for impeachment or vote for removal because they think the president is engaging in such a disastrous administration overall?
It's hard to even measure or psychoanalyze what's going on in Republicans' minds. Are they more open to impeaching over the Ukraine scandal because they're angry about Syria? Like, it's hard to tie all those things together, but what we do see is Republicans are not rushing to defend the president on almost any of the substance of the things we're talking about. Very minimally, they're fighting over process matters and minutiae about how Democrats are running the inquiry. And we've even seen a couple of Republicans, like Mitt Romney, and we saw a Republican from Florida, Francis Rooney, say he's open-minded about impeachment if the facts continue to go where they're going. And then he announced his retirement shortly thereafter. But there is some movement among Republicans, even if it's minimal at this point.
Dahlia, just one other thought on Rudy Giuliani before we go. Is Rudy doing exactly what he's trying to find on Hunter Biden, that is, using his connections to the White House to make money in business?
Boy, it sure looks like it. I mean, it's hard to construe what he's doing as anything else. And it's been interesting because he's been reasonably quiet the last couple of days. But one of the things he is squawking about is that, you know, all of these witch hunts against him are imperiling his ability to make money off his connections. So, you know, I think he's pretty open about the fact that he has had a massive client base that wanted him to provide access in exchange for money. Now, to be clear, Washington is full of people. I mean, that's right. This is what happens. You leave the administration and everybody then goes on to trade access to the administration for, you know, favors. So that's not unheard of. But what's strange about Rudy is he's still holding himself out as Trump's private attorney. He's still, I don't think, has walked back claims that he was working on behalf of the State Department. So it's a very strange thing that he is both, as you say, making money from private clients in exchange for access, in exchange for directly lobbying like Rex Tillerson at the time, or the current Justice Department at the time, on behalf of clients. So it's done. But what's really strange is at the same time, he's also saying, oh, I'm the president's lawyer, too. And also, P.S., I work for the State Department. So there's I think, behavior that we've always seen that makes us feel a little hinky. What's strange here is he has, I think, continued to say, but also I work for the president. And that's where it gets very, very problematic.
Kyle, last thing from you today as a congressional reporter. When are we going to see some of these hearings take place in public on television? And what's your latest on the timeline for when an impeachment vote might actually take place?
I truly believe that they have not made a decision on this yet. But the best thinking that we hear from our sources here and from lawmakers is that they will complete the round of interviews with willing and cooperative witnesses, then confront this long list of resistant witnesses like the White House and others associated with the White House, and decide maybe we just have to cut it off here, move this to the Judiciary Committee for public-facing hearings, and start drafting the articles themselves.
Kyle Chaney covers Congress for Politico. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court and other legal things for Slate and hosts their legal affairs podcast, Amicus. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.